I'm Joy Cardine with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday morning, March the 13th. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock. And our guest this hour has written an op-ed piece that is in this morning's New York Times. It starts, "Today more than three-quarters of the world's oil is owned and controlled by governments. It wasn't always this way. Until about 35 years ago, the world's oil was largely in the hands of seven corporations based in the United States and Europe. Skipping ahead, Iraq's oil reserves, thought to be the second largest in the world, have always been high on the corporate wish list. Skipping ahead, a new oil law set to go before the Iraqi parliament this month would, if passed, go a long way toward helping the oil companies achieve their goal. The Iraq hydrocarbon law would take the majority of Iraq's oil out of the exclusive hands of the Iraqi government and open it to international oil companies for a generation or more. Why would the Iraqi government do this? And does this just prove that this war was indeed for the oil? We will talk with our guest and welcome your questions for her at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, toll free from anywhere. If you're in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. And the question we will ask you is, whose oil is it anyway? Should the Iraqi government privatize its oil, or should the Iraqi oil be in the hands of foreign oil companies? Our guest is Antonia Juhas. She's an oil policy analyst with the Oil Change International. She is author of the book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time, and she teaches at New College in California and by video at McMaster College in Ontario. She joins us from San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Absolutely.
And we already have a number of callers already lining up to talk about this.
Great.
I want to talk about something also. I want to talk about this law and everything too, but it's in the news this morning that Halliburton is moving its corporate headquarters from Houston to Dubai. Does this have anything to do with this Iraqi oil law?
Well, it does, part and parcel. Certainly, a significant part of the Bush administration's agenda has been to, as much as possible, open up U.S. Corporate access, U.S. corporate access to the Middle East, a region that has been certainly, compared to other regions of the world, quite closed off to U.S. companies, particularly oil companies, and Halliburton is an oil services company. And the administration has done quite a bit to facilitate greater access, and that includes, I would argue, a war, and also an aggressive push for free trade agreements between the United States and Middle Eastern governments. Through that process, there has certainly been an emphasis on the administration that it should be, that Middle Eastern countries should be letting U.S. companies in. And there are pluses and minuses for the Middle Eastern countries of doing that. And that's definitely where the money is, and that's where Halliburton is moving. They're doing quite poorly financially in the United States right now, the reason being the intense backlash against their war profiteering and organizing by citizens and by members of Congress to expose Halliburton's war profiteering, and their profits and stock have been dropping in the United States. So it's certainly a wise business decision for Halliburton to shift over to Dubai, and it's definitely a signal of you know, what this administration has been trying to do from the beginning.
All right, well, let's talk about this National Hydrocarbon Law, the new oil law that the Iraqi parliament will be voting on. What is this?
This is it's the brainchild of the Bush administration. It's literally something the Bush administration has been working on since its first days in office, and I would also argue even earlier than that. And it takes Iraq legislatively from a nationalized oil system that was almost completely closed off specifically to American and British oil companies, except for marketing contracts, into basically a privatized oil system that is totally open to American and British companies, and actually, I would argue, with a preferential bias towards American and British companies given the presence of a foreign occupation. And it's basically the smoking gun revealing the war as a war motivated by oil. It demonstrates that the Bush administration has spent 4 years working to get the Iraqis to reverse 35 years of their history, a major victory of their history and their independence from colonialism, was taking back their oil and taking control of their oil production. And now, through a war, and I would certainly argue another imperial exercise, the United States is reversing that and taking their oil back.
Well, now, is it fair to say the United States is reversing that? Didn't a cabinet, a council of the Iraqi government vote to do this?
Well, the cabinet has voted for it, and now it goes to the parliament. Mm-hmm. And yes, there are certainly Iraqis who are supporting this, and that's a question that needs to go one step deeper, which is, first of all, how was this government formed? Who is this government? Is it representative of the Iraqi people, or is it something else? And I, in my book, The Bush Agenda, go into detail in all of the failures of the election in Iraq that resulted in this government, which was not considered a valid election by leading international election observers, one of the main reasons being that election observers couldn't be in the country to observe, which is mm-hmm. what they do. Even in Palestine, in a time of war, during elections, international election observers were able to be in the country. And most of the candidates didn't even put their names on ballots until the day of the vote, because they were afraid they would be assassinated. So people didn't even know, in fact, who they were voting for. And, of course, it was a state of martial law, and, of course, the Sunnis boycotted the election. And the people who we see in power today in Iraq represent three sets of interests. One is Bush administration interests. The other is a select group of Shia and a select group of Kurds. And representatives of those three groups have agreed to this oil law because it does very well by their interests. And it's a hobbled together deal that fits the interests of those in power. It is certainly not a law that is representative of the interests of the Iraqi public, but most importantly, it's a law that's been rushed through without any public participation, without transparency, without public knowledge, that's going to lead to a dramatic transformation of the most important resource in the country. And the groups that have been able to speak out publicly against this law, in particular, Iraq's unions and all of its unions, not just the oil workers' unions, but that one, but those ones too, have said this law is absolutely wrong. It's wrong for us. But most importantly, what we need is less pressure from the outside and more time to have an actual democratic process to figure out what it is that we should do with our oil.
Yeah. Is it the conventional wisdom that the parliament will indeed go along with this?
Well, there is definitely a movement within the parliament to resist the law, and a colleague of mine, Raed Jarar, who I co-wrote a piece on the law with for Foreign Policy and Focus, he's an Iraqi-American, and he recently returned from Iman from a meeting of Iraqi parliamentarians who oppose the law. And they're going to make a concerted effort. The problem is that the members of the parliament, again, as I said, weren't popularly mm-hmm. elected because their names weren't on the ballot. They were, until the last day, they were mostly elected based on the parties that they are members of, and those parties are represented in the cabinet, and the cabinet has already passed the law. So there is definitely concern that the parliament will just act as a rubber stamp unless the parliamentarians are able to generate enough public awareness about the law, of which there is very little in Iraq right now, and hopefully stall the process.
We're talking with Antonia Juhas. She is the author of the book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time, also an oil policy analyst with Oil Change International. talking with us about the ideas she puts forth in an editorial that's a guest editorial that's in the New York Times this morning, talking about a new oil law set to go before the Iraqi parliament sometime within the next few weeks that would, if passed, turn over Iraqi's oil, take the oil out of the control of the Iraqi government, and open it up to foreign oil companies. What do you think of this? What questions do you have? Our guest says that this is the smoking gun, that the war in Iraq was a war motivated by oil. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. 21 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, March the 13th. And that promo for Ben Maron's program was a week late and a dollar short. Actually, what Ben will be talking about today after 5 o'clock, the dangers of using weapons in space. He will be talking with Helen Caldicott. She's the author of a new book, War in Heaven, The Arms Race in Outer Space, and that's the topic after 5. We're talking about a new Iraqi oil law and wondering what you think in terms of whether the oil in Iraq should be controlled by the Iraqi government or foreign oil companies. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And since our lines are full, let's go to the phone. Stephen Superior, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Good topic. I would say that the war was definitely dealt with oil and other national priorities in the United States. But the question I have is, how do we handle our oil in this country? We're, I believe, privatized, but yet we heavily regulate to control the oil industry as much as possible. Would that we tax them a little more. But so how do we handle it versus this law that they're trying to pass in Iraq?
Sure. Good question. It's very interesting. The law that they're trying to pass in, well, the United States is the absolute outlier in how we deal with our oil. About 78% of all of the world's oil is essentially controlled by governments. It's under nationalized oil systems, and that happened in response to essentially U.S. and British corporations controlling the world's oil for most of history, and then the oil governments deciding that they should get some of the benefit of their oil and taking the oil back, essentially. In the United States, we had in the past a fairly heavily regulated oil system where we kept out foreign oil, we heavily subsidized our domestic industry, but we always followed the rule that whoever owned the land owned the oil below it, so that oil is essentially fully privatized in the United States, except for in the few places where the federal government sits on land that below it has oil. And as you said, we still continue, of course, to heavily subsidize the oil industry. Essentially everywhere else in the world, oil is owned by the government, and then it signs contracts with foreign companies. What the law in Iraq would do would move Iraq closer to the U.S. model and away from the way the rest of the world does it by giving the Iraqi government only control of about a third of its oil, and all the rest would be open to private foreign control, using a kind of contract called a production sharing agreement, which is absolutely the wish list, the wish model of international oil companies, and hardly used at all by any oil wealthy countries, because these contracts give the company control of the oil for 20 to 35 years. They give them disproportionate revenue and profits. In some versions of the oil bill that we've seen in Iraq, the profit split was actually 70% of the profits going to the foreign company, only 30% staying in Iraq. Also, the foreign companies in Iraq don't have to reinvest any of their money in the Iraqi economy, partner with Iraqi companies, hire Iraqi workers, or, you know, ensure that any benefit flows into Iraq. And it, all of Iraq's neighbors, so Iran and Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, have nationalized models where they sign limited partnership agreements with foreign companies. So they let foreign companies in, but for contracts that are about 2 years long and where there's very specific and revenue sharing that, that benefits the government, not the company. And I would imagine that Iraq, freed from the external pressure of the foreign occupation and the Bush administration, would probably end up with a model like that, a nationalized system where they invite in foreign companies, but on terms that are more to the benefit of Iraq rather than the companies.
Yeah. So does this, Ms. Juhas, taking the title from a different piece that you wrote that was posted on the Huffington Post, does this mean this oil law in Iraq mean that U.S. oil companies are going to win the Iraq war?
Well, you know, it's certainly, as I point out in the various articles, the Bush administration and U.S. corporations began planning early for their interests in Iraq, that they would want to transform Iraq's oil system, that they wanted to get their hands on Iraq's oil system, because just to point this out, essentially right before the most recent U.S. invasion of Iraq, Saddam Hussein was trying to the best of his ability to get the sanctions removed. The sanctions, of course, were being applied against Iraq. And so he started signing oil contracts with foreign oil companies for the first time. But the contracts were being signed specifically with members of the UN Security Council, China, Russia, and Germany, who might challenge the sanctions at the UN. So these companies, the companies from these countries, China, Russia, and Germany, actually started signing oil contracts with Saddam, but they weren't willing to go against the sanctions. When U.S. corporations and the Bush administration sat down in 2001, they looked at a map of Iraq and all of its oil wells and saw this very scary potential future for them, which was that if the sanctions were removed, and global public opinion was definitely turning in this direction because of the horrific impact of the sanctions on the Iraqi public, then all of the other companies from around the world would get Iraq's oil, and the U.S. would be shut out. So they went forward with a plan for a war, a plan to get rid of those existing contracts, those are now gone, to open up Iraq to their access, to get rid of Saddam, to put in a new legal structure, to put in a military that would facilitate the transfer of oil to the U.S. companies. And if the oil law passes, and if the U.S. military stays on the ground in Iraq, yes, I certainly believe that the war for oil would have been won. And that, it certainly in my mind, would be a catastrophic result of this war.
Victor in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Victor.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning to your guests. In my opinion, it really should, most of it, go to the Iraqi people, but it's never going to happen. Ever since it was carved out of the Ottoman Empire from 1916, we all know, generally most of us know, Iraq is really an artificial country, and it was formed just for the basis of petroleum and oil and all its resources. So I'm not surprised if this deal goes through and, you know, the Iraqi people get the short end of the stick. To me, another problem with this is, to me, that'll give, you know, more, you know, excuse for the insurgencies is, because they realize that we're getting the short end of the stick of this deal. That's going to increase the insurgency over there. We're going to keep troops over there for the longest.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with you on the second point that, you know, this is a terrible situation now for U.S. soldiers in Iraq, the Iraqi public in general, and I would argue the American public. Believe me, the rest of the world and certainly the Iraqis all believed without qualification that the United States was going to war in Iraq for its oil. If the end of the war is that U.S. corporations now have Iraq's oil, it's certainly not going to be a more peaceful outcome. The since the invasion of Iraq, global acts of terrorism targeted against the United States and its allies have increased dramatically. This, in my mind, would be a tremendous instigator of more violence and something I certainly personally would want to head off, if for no other reason than for that reason. On the other side, yes, Iraq was a created entity following because of interest in its resources. But Iraqis, that doesn't mean that they haven't been able to have a country and make it work, and that doesn't mean that they haven't been able to reclaim their oil and make it work. Following independence and nationalization from about 1961 till Saddam Hussein took power in 1979, Iraq was a golden example of what an oil-rich country could do with its oil. It reinvested its wealth heavily into public service, building sophisticated infrastructure, providing free health care and child care and education, and ending up with a very healthy and educated population. They were able to pull themselves together. It's not inevitable for the Iraqis that they live in a dismal future, and it's certainly not inevitable that the United States continues its military occupation. I firmly believe that there's still hope for Iraq, and that one of the best things that we can do is not to give up on them, and also not to think that it's inevitable that our military or our corporations will win. And thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks very much, Victor, for the call. I was just looking at a piece written by the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Zalmay Khalizad, saying that this national hydrocarbon law that was approved by the Council of Ministers will serve as a vehicle to unify Iraq and give all Iraqis a shared stake in their country's future. Why don't you agree with him?
Well, Ambassador Khalilzad has just absolutely done a yeoman's work at doing everything he physically can to get this law passed. He's been in every single meeting between the Iraqis, in the negotiating sessions, in the drafting sessions, making sure that this law becomes a reality. And he has been the point person for applying as much pressure as possible on the Iraqis. And he, as the Bush administration does, emphasizes one part of this law, a part that I think is a very good part of this law, which would redistribute Iraq's oil wealth from the central government across the country based on a per capita distribution of oil, which is great. Previously, Saddam Hussein collected the oil wealth and distributed it based on his own interests, and certainly not in any sort of fair manner. And that's a fantastic proposal and would be a great step towards creating more equality in Iraq. However, that proposal is dramatically undercut by the fact that the vast majority of the revenue won't be around to be distributed. It'll be going off to U.S. oil corporations. So, you know, that provision alone would be wonderful. That provision coupled with the rest of the bill is fairly insignificant, except for as a wonderful thing to hone on to for the public. On the other side, unity in Iraq. In Iraq, this law is being called the Separate Iraq Bill. Because to get the representative Shia and Kurds to sign on to the bill, the Bush administration had to give more authority to the regional governments on contract decisions. And people within Iraq think that this is a precursor to allowing Iraq to split along regional divides. And they think it's a horrific choice if the ultimate interest is actually keeping Iraq held together. So I think Ambassador Khalilzad has done a wonderful job in propaganda with his op-ed and a wonderful job of persuasion in Iraq. And, you know, I hope that my op-ed is a way of shining a little bit more light on the rest of the bill and what it does.
Next we go to Matt in Milwaukee. Hi, Matt.
Yes, I sense a little bit of demagoguery in what's going on here, only because the one piece of wealth that Iraq has is locked underground. It takes an enormous amount of sophistication, and I might add an enormous amount of risk, to pull that oil out of the ground. If you were an oil company investing mega billions into this country to resurrect its oil infrastructure and to pump it out, you must be paid for this risk. you could turn around at any moment and have an Iranian missile, you know, destroy what you have, etc. So at least in the early going, it will seem as if there are enormous profits going to the oil companies, but what it really is compensation for risk, which can evaporate in a moment, a la Chavez nationalizing in Venezuela, etc. So I'd like to hear your guest comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That is exactly the point. Iraq's oil wealth is the key to its economic future. I would absolutely disagree with you that it's locked underground because of deficiencies among the Iraqis. As I said, the Iraqis had an incredibly successful, far more successful oil system when they were running it by far than when the Americans and British were running it before. What happened was Saddam Hussein. What happened was the invasion of Iran and an eight-year-long prolonged war with Iran, then an invasion of Kuwait and a war with the United States, and then sanctions. Since the war began, the U.S. war in Iraq, in fact, the Iraqis have done quite a successful job of keeping their oil pumping, given the circumstances. Prior to the invasion, Iraq was pumping about 2.5 million barrels of oil a day. Since the invasion, it was averaging between 2.2 and 2.3 million barrels of oil a day. And that dropped off precipitously, most recently because of the surge of violence in Baghdad. And the Iraqis have actually been receiving a tremendous amount of return on that oil because, contrary to your statement, they're actually, in terms of oil and exploration and production of oil, there's no risk in Iraq. The only risk is, of course, the fact that there's an occupation and a civil war. Iraq's oil is incredibly well mapped out. There are 80 known oil fields. 17 of them are currently being developed. The rest, again, well mapped out. Where the oil is very well known. And Iraq's oil is right below the surface and very accessible. It costs about 60 cents per barrel to produce Iraq's oil. And, of course, it's selling at $62 a barrel today. So the Iraqis are bringing in about $3 billion a year already in oil. I would argue what they need at this point is, one, an end to the hostilities, and the best thing to facilitate that would be the end of the occupation. Iraq's oil infrastructure is still being targeted by insurgents. That targeting, I would argue, has far more to do with a statement of resistance to the occupation rather than resistance to the oil infrastructure. And if the occupation ended, I would imagine a good deal of the targeting to the oil infrastructure would end as well. And two, Iraq, yes, has spent 11 years in the darkness and most certainly needs external expertise. And hopefully international oil companies would be willing to provide that expertise on a basis more similar to Iraq's partners. Or neighbors, like Kuwait, for example, which the United States partners with quite heavily, and Saudi Arabia, of course, where the United States partners quite heavily, and would provide that expertise on contract terms that serve the economic interests of Iraqis at a desperate time of need and wouldn't demand from them their lifeblood to open up their willingness to participate in Iraq's oil system.
Thanks to Matt. Linda in Monroe. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Ms. Juhasz. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Now, isn't it a coincidence that gas went under $2 before the election, and now in California it's over $3? Now, the war in Iraq has always been about oil, just like Ted Koppel said. Now Halliburton's moving their headquarters over to Dubai? Now, they should absolutely be investigated by Congress what's going on over there. And I also read an article in our local paper written by you in February that the oil companies want to privatize Iraq's oil, and they want 70% of the profits, which I think are exorbitant, and a 30-year contract. Now, I'd like to get a 70% return on a CD I buy at the bank. I think somebody should be impeached, and please comment.
That's great. Thank you. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just ask for everything you ever wanted and use the 140,000 members of a military to demand it? I mean, that's what we're seeing happen. They're trying to get, being the corporations and was facilitated by the Bush administration, their wish list. I can see why they would ask for it. That's their job to ask for it. it's our job to expose the reality of what they're asking for, and to say that it's not possible. It's not something that you get just because you want it doesn't mean you get it. And it's our job to do that in the freedom of the democracy that we have that Iraqis don't have, which is the capacity to actually say to our government, and this is what I think we should do, that the pressure must be removed. And we have to demand of our Democratic members of Congress that if they truly desire to win the election in 2008, which seems to be their goal, that they're going to have to actually represent the interests of the American public, which is to end the occupation, but also to end the pressure, the external pressure being applied on Iraq for passage of the oil law. In terms of gasoline prices, most certainly. I think there was a combined effort. Let's just make this point clear. The way that oil prices are determined within the United States, gasoline prices, about 47% is determined simply by the price of crude, which is largely determined by OPEC. But the remaining, more than 50%, is determined by the oil companies and by taxes. So we have very low taxes on gasoline in the United States. They only account for about 20%. The remaining chunk is all the corporations. It's their costs for refining, distributing, selling, and profit. Because oil companies in the United States are heavily vertically integrated, that means they control the whole process from production to refining to sales. They control a large chunk of that and can, in times of need, reduce their cut, meaning reduce the price of gasoline. In addition, I think there's a very good case to be made that very public meetings that took place between the Bush administration, including President Bush, and the Saudis right before the elections probably had something to do with the Saudis increasing oil supply right before the elections and bringing down price.
And thanks, Linda, for the call. And it might have been you. I think it was Linda, if not another listener, who suggested that we talk with our guest this hour, Antonia Juhas, who is an oil policy analyst with Oil Change International and author of The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time. Our guest also teaches at New College in California and via video at McMaster University in Ontario. She is the author of an op-ed that's in the New York Times this morning where she criticizes a national oil law in Iraq. The Iraqi parliament this month or in the next several weeks is going to take this up and could pass it. It would take the majority of Iraq's oil out of the hands of the Iraqi government and open it up to international oil companies for a generation or more. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Concern for American war veterans has escalated since conditions at Walter Reed were made public. And after 9, Kathleen's guest from the VA hospital in Madison will talk about the care and treatment of vets in Wisconsin. That's in our next hour. We're talking about this new Iraqi oil law that would turn over control of the oil in Iraq to foreign companies, private companies, talking with a guest, Antonia Juhas, about this. And our next caller is Derek in Round Lake, Illinois. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning to you, Ms. Cardine, and good morning to you, Ms. Juhas.
Good morning.
I've read your article in the Indies Times about a couple months back. Very, very enlightening. I just want to make one point. 2 months ago, I was on a flight from Miami to Caracas, and there was a group of four gentlemen next to me. And our flight was our arrival was delayed. Therefore, there was apparently either for me and for the gentleman actually over there, there's nobody waiting as far as the pickup. And for about half an hour, one gentleman was obviously very visibly upset when a gentleman calling for the group of four gentlemen was mentioned the company name, and the company name was Halliburton. Mm. So it comes across the corporations that do not necessarily have the ideological hard line or so. They just simply go to any extent to go with any government in order to make a buck. And I'd like you to make comment on that. Iraq is paid, obviously, not any kind of specific ideological difference at this point. It just simply, it's very convenient for them to really go because that's where the money is to be made.
Sure. They certainly want to go where the money is to be made. When Cheney was CEO of Halliburton, he was very explicit in his desire to get into every country that the United States had limited trade relations with and sanctions against. Iran, Libya, Iraq was Saddam Hussein, and he took Halliburton into Iran and into Iraq when the United States had a specific sanctions regime against those countries. And yes, I agree. The question is, to what extent will the government facilitate, the U.S. government facilitate or stymie their access around the world? And to what extent will other countries be able to determine the terms by which U.S. companies operate in their midst? And those of us who are advocates of what I call fair trade as opposed to quote-unquote free trade or what I call corporate globalization, believe that countries should be able to set the terms by which foreign companies operate in their midst. And what the Bush administration has sought to do all over the place, and particularly in the Middle East, and the particular emphasis is on the Middle East because the Middle East has been closed to U.S. companies for so long, and because, oh, by the way, they have a tremendous amount of the world's oil and the vast majority of the world's remaining oil, has been to do whatever it can to limit the ability of foreign governments to limit access to U.S. companies. So it's done very well by companies like Halliburton and Bechtel and Chevron and Exxon and the like.
I wanted you, Ms. Juhas, to talk a little bit about the energy task force headed by Vice President Dick Cheney that you talk about in your editorial and how that ties into this Iraq oil law.
Sure. The Cheney Energy Task Force began meeting 10 days into the first Bush administration. And this group, we still don't know everything that happened in this group because Cheney has steadfastly held on to the meeting discussions as secret meeting materials. Although the Supreme Court has gotten some information out and some private interest groups have gotten some information out. And we know that this was a series of meetings to develop a new national energy policy for the United States that took place between Cheney and the heads of the America's largest oil and energy companies, including Halliburton, Bechtel, Chevron, Exxon, you name it, including coal and nuclear. And that they, one of the things they did was make very clear in their recommendations that the United States needed to gain greater access to Middle East oil, and in particular, they focused on Iraq and laid out a series of maps of Iraq's oil, how much oil was in each field, a list that was called Foreign Suitors to Iraqi Oil that listed the other companies from other parts of the world that had contracts with Saddam Hussein and had interest in Iraq's oil. They also recommended that the United States government should help Middle East governments to work to essentially privatize or allow in foreign investment into their oil sectors. And I argue in the New York Times op-ed today that that's precisely what this oil law does. It fulfills the objectives laid out in the Cheney Energy Task Force and in particular with the oil law. Transforms Iraq's oil sector to the interests of the planning from Cheney's Energy Task Force.
And Art in Appleton is with us now. Hi, Art.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning to your guest. I kind of missed a little bit of the part of the discussion that you were talking about earlier regarding the UN sanctions and the fact that the U.S. was looking at the map and saw how things were being carved up. Based on the other members of the UN Security Council, and it almost sounded like what you're saying is that the United States looked at this and suddenly realized, oops, we've got an issue here, and we need to react to this somehow. And then it started me thinking about how did the sanctions come to be in the first place? Because I know that there were about 17 of them that were basically put in, and did the fact that those were just continuously layered one upon another and never really acted on enable the other countries to basically set up the country the way that they wanted to? And I'm thinking of that as the initial action, but then ultimately leading that you know, could that have led up to the oil for food scandal that was involved so many members of the Security Council and others?
Thanks for the questions. First of all, the sanctions, of course, followed another Bush war against Iraq, the earlier Bush war against Iraq, where I believe that the former President Bush was definitely interested in replacing Saddam Hussein, but wasn't willing or wasn't interested in owning Iraq in the same way that this administration has proven itself to be, wasn't willing to go the distance and really occupy and change Iraq's laws, and was hoping that it would be able to unseat Saddam, get a new leader in, and a leader that would be willing to play better ball with the United States, and in particular with U.S. oil companies. But then Bush Sr. was out and Clinton was in, and I think that Clinton didn't have any interest whatsoever in engaging militarily with Iraq, and that his way of essentially not dealing was by continuing the sanctions for 8 years. Now, that said, of course, the sanctions were brutal and horrific, and I don't mean to take away from that, but I actually think that that was President Clinton's way of keeping an arm's distance from Iraq. He did engage in military incursions in Iraq, but nothing along the scope of this current president or the previous president. What happened then was not an oops. There was definitely a concerted planning within the 8 years while Clinton was president by the men who were in the previous Bush regime and in the current Bush regime to get back into Iraq, and this time to, quote-unquote, do it right, to not just replace Saddam, but to replace his entire government and his entire political and economic system. And that urgency, that interest became far more urgent and needing action in the minds of the members of the administration and U.S. oil companies when the writing was getting increasingly on the wall that the sanctions were probably gonna end before Saddam was removed, and that they were going to have to act. And now this was they're acting literally 10 days into the Bush administration, so there was no dallying. The Bush administration starts, and they immediately start making plans, which are if we're going to get this oil, we got to get it now, because basically the other countries and the other companies are going to get it, and that's how I map out the trajectory in the Bush agenda.
All right. Thanks to Art. Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. The project for the new American century, we unfortunately never hear much about this. I remember when I first got my computer and got online in 1996, I searched think tanks and found this group. And their agenda, when I read it, I was shocked. Their agenda was to take control of oil in the Middle East to secure our security. That was the idea, that we'd be secure and our country'd be able to keep slobbering it down the way that we do. Now, When Bush came into office and he supposedly picked his cabinet, it happened to be all these people from the Project for the New American Century: Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Pearl. All these guys, like they were a team, and they chose this one guy and put some money behind him, hopefully to get him in office so that they can control what they want to do. When I read it, I knew when they got in office, I knew they're going to be going after oil.
And thank you, Dave. And we certainly talked about that on this program, so you heard it here, too. But we did have another caller as well who couldn't stay with us, Ms. Juhas, who said she was frustrated that this is the first time that she was hearing about this Iraq oil law that we're talking about this hour. Is there not enough attention in the media to these issues?
I would certainly say that, and I share her frustration. I've definitely spent the last 4 years myself trying to draw as much attention mm-hmm. to it as I could. I am as surprised as anyone, frankly, that the New York Times picked this article, this op-ed to run of mine, and thrilled by it and intrigued by it. It's, you know, certainly going to get more attention than just about anything, and forever thankful to shows like yours who have been actually listening to me talk and listening to me talk about the law, and slowly but surely spreading the information. There just hasn't been enough focus, and I think, you know, now's the time we start to bring that focus forward. I focus in my book, The Bush Agenda, quite explicitly on the Project for the New American Century, but also on the oil law and its early gestation, and I encourage folks to look at that to see more on those topics. Mm-hmm. I think the Project for the New American Century was an outgrowth of the end of the previous Bush regime and something for the guys to do in between before they came back into the new one.
Thank you, Dave. Dan in White Lake is next. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I would like to say to your guest that ordinarily I would be agreeing with her. However, what we've learned over the last 6 years, irrespective of the fact that our invasion of Iraq was illegal, is that, first of all, if you know a little history, the boundaries on the Arabian Peninsula were set by the British and the French after the First World War. So it's an accident of history and geography that here we have these Arabs sitting on this oil. They did nothing to acquire it. It's a mere accident that they're sitting on top of it. And the Arabs were described by Gertrude Bell, a correspondent for the London Times during and after the First World War, as ungovernable. I think they are in the process at this stage of the game of proving themselves to be such even now.
Yeah, so, you know what? I'm sorry, Dan. We have less than a minute to go for our guest to respond to your comments. Ms. Juhas?
I think folks could say the same thing about Americans in America. If you'll recall, it wasn't our land when we showed up here either, but you know, we've made a game of it. And you know, accidents of history still have to play out today, and you know, we have to do our best to help ensure that Iraqis have the chance to have the type of democracy that we've promised them.
So the Iraqi parliament is going to vote on this when, do we know?
It comes before the parliament this month. We don't know when they're going to take it up. So now is definitely the time to call your representative. On my organization's website, which is priceofoil.org, you'll see a draft letter to your member of Congress that you can write, some ideas on actions you can take. Also on my other website, thebushagenda.net, you'll see protests taking place all across the country that folks can join in on.
Thank you very much, Antonia Juhas. Thanks to Karen Prager and Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine.